This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Grant Smith, is by now familiar with Takes on the World listeners, but just to bring you up to date, he is the director of IRMEP, the Washington-based Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, and a tireless investigator and historian of the pro-Israel lobby, which is why you'll never hear him on the mainstream media. He has authored a number of books which should be required reading for anyone wishing to understand the enormous power wielded by Israel and its supporters in the United States. All of them can be found, as well as a treasure trove of information, by going to his website, irmep.org. Each spring, IRMEP hosts a major conference on the Israel lobby at the National Press Club with the Washington Report on the Middle East Affairs that features major speakers from the political, academic, and journalistic world who have had the temerity to recognize Israel lobby for what it is and speak out about it. While the media routinely ignores it, the lobby still being a taboo subject, C-SPAN has on occasion covered them, but videos from those conferences can also be found on the IRMEP website. And so I want to welcome once again Grant Smith to Takes on the World.
Hey, thanks for having me on again, Jeff.
Yeah, I started my program earlier reporting on the latest semi-annual visit of members of Congress from both parties to Israel, and how, thanks to the cooperation of the U.S. media, the American public continues to be unaware of these trips at a time when most members of the House are visiting their home districts. According to Jonathan Tobin, writing the Jewish online journal Allgemeiner, the reason for that is that, quote, this is Tobin says, members of Congress going to Israel to express support for the Jewish state is such a mainstream and ordinary thing that it isn't considered newsworthy, end quote. I take it you might have a different opinion.
Yeah, I have a big difference with that catch. The whole article is an extreme exercise in absolute 180-degree reporting. The bottom line is, members of Congress going to Israel is an extremely big deal because one in three privately funded trips leaving the United States is headed to that single country. If you look back over time, and you've already noted that these occur during recesses before election years, 131 trips last year, 373 the year before, 219 in 2016, 345 in 2015. This is an extreme amount of congressional travel to one country, and then, of course, they are ferried about by, in many cases, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee staffers and given an extremely distorted view of the entire situation. So these are extremely expensive lobbying junkets lasting 8 days, costing $10,000 each. And it's extremely disconcerting that the only thing you see in the press is something like in the Allgemeiner that's getting everything backwards.
And that, of course, is a journal intended mostly for actually right-wing Jewish readers, so it doesn't get into the mainstream press.
Right. There have been almost, like you say, almost no mention of these trips except for some occasional alternative media. And, you know, one of the things that you can't assume is that most Americans even know these trips are going on. So just to mention a recent poll that we did, no one, as far as I know, has ever been asked by a mainstream public pollster, such as Gallup or Ipsos or, you know, a CNN poll, about what they make of these trips. But if you do ask them about, you know, again, in this case, the first wave of House Democrats going on a trip, and we did ask 2,000 voting-age Americans between August 8 and 10 where they believe they should be going, 65.7% said they should be returning to their districts, and only 27.4% said that they believe that they should be going on Israel lobby-funded trips. So these trips, by that alone, you can say they are not popular with constituents who are already ranking government, and especially Congress, as just below their extremely low rankings of the news media.
Well, it's interesting about who's paying for them. Some years back, I remember Congress did pass a law saying that foreign lobbies should not be able to send members of Congress on paid trips. And so it turns out AIPAC established their front group, a 501c3, tax-exempt to do it, calling it a charity. Tell us about that.
Sure. The American Israel Education Foundation was actually founded in 1988, and they did that as a, quote, supporting organization of AIPAC, unquote, in their papers to the IRS, saying, we just want to form so that we can funnel some educational money into AIPAC initiatives. Well, you know, that means that they wanted to get tax-exempt donations where AIPAC could only get non-tax-deductible contributions. But today, this shell company, this conduit, is funding by writing a check from those extremely, you know, wealthy, high-net-worth donors covering all of these trips, which AIPAC is orchestrating. The AIEF, this foundation, has no employees. It's housed within AIPAC. It's merely a piece of paper, and yet they continue to insist that this 2007 law, which came in the wake of the Jack Abramoff scandal, which was designed to prevent lobbying junkets, that it doesn't apply to them because, oh, there's this old and established educational organization that's actually doing all of the payments for the trips. If you dig deeper into that, though, all you see once again is regulatory capture of the government. In this case, you have the AIEF applying for tax-exempt status, and this is all submitted by Milton Cherney, who had his name on the filing papers with all the arguments about why this educational charity should forever have tax-exempt status. Milton Cherney didn't mention one single thing about congressional junkets to Israel, and nobody questioned it at the IRS, which within 4 months granted this conduit tax-exempt status. Well, who was Milton Cherney? Milton Cherney was the technical advisor in charge of tax-exempt rulings at the IRS National Office in Washington, D.C., right up until September of 1988. There was no way the IRS was then or ever going to question anything that this AIPAC twin did in terms of congressional junkets, and they never have, despite, I might add, Jeff, many complaints and filings to the IRS that this is nothing more than what they call a sham or alter ego organization, and asking them to yank the organization's tax-exempt status. I mean, we've talked many, many times about other units at the Treasury, but this is just another unit at the Treasury that has been captured by the lobby.
It's an extraordinary story because it's just part of a pattern, whether it's in the Treasury Department, where they have the Special Department of Terrorist Financing set up by George Bush, who is an exclusive province of lobby people. I remember Stuart Levy, who was appointed by Bush after Obama became president. He went over to see Netanyahu on the U.S. tax dollars to inform Netanyahu. Yeah, not to worry because nothing would change with Obama as the president. But we have even now this very important issue of China taking over the port of Haifa, which should be a headline story in the American press. The Senate passed inserted in the National Defense Act, which I mentioned on the air, a sense of the Senate non-binding resolution asking Israel not to do it. And that, too, was overlooked by the media. Is this collaboration or cooperation? What's the difference?
I call it irony. I mean, if you look back a few years ago when Dubai Ports tried to take over some management of a handful of U.S. ports, the Israel lobby went nuts over that and made all sorts of allegations about national security threats to the United States. And so to have, again, a supposed ally, which is so dependent on U.S. largesse, both charitable and military, sort of disregarding this sort of thing. I just call that irony.
I was just looking at a book by a very famous writer from the 30s named Vincent Sheehan. Mm-hmm. He was the most famous American journalist, happened to be in what was then Palestine 90 years ago this month, when riots broke out between Jews and Arabs in that British Mandate Palestine. And he was there to describe how young Jewish pioneers instigated the riot, which led to massacre of Jews not involved in Hebron, but also hundreds of dead, both sides. And he wrote about the story, the way he saw it, instigated by these young Jewish pioneers waving what became the Israeli flag, it wasn't at the time, outside the Temple Mount, what the Jews call the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. That stirred the riots. So he wrote the way he saw it. And in one day, the world got 3,000 letters attacking him in New York. So this is the media is very careful about what they write about Israel, because there's obviously listeners or advertisers or readers that are going to complain, and probably it's just easier not to do it. I don't know how we would explain it otherwise.
Yeah, I think you see that the more carefully you look at what's going on with the news media and the more people you talk to. I would even say that, well, you've spoken to Paul Finley, and I've spoken to him too. As you know and mentioned, he wrote the book They Dare Speak Out, and it was extremely important and generated a huge amount of readership. And yet he was only once able to get out the name of his new organization, their phone number and address, over national television. And just one time, and that formed the basis for a new organization, a chapter-based, nationally headquartered organization he was trying to found to really challenge all of this corruption that he had exposed in his book. And yet he never again, after that single moment, was ever allowed on any sort of national televised platform to mention his cause, to mention his organization, to put out a phone number. And they pretty much had to go with that tiny support base that he got that one single time. The mistake was never made again. And it's amazing to witness, but once you realize how it operates, the letter generation, the forms that are created and circulated to ask advertisers to remove support from any offending show. I mean, there's an entire network of media watchdog organizations out there that are having a tremendously negative impact on this debate, which is almost non-existent. So you get these snippets, these small points of light out there where you can actually get some solid independent reporting breaking out to any sort of significant audience. But it's rare, and unfortunately, it hasn't gotten any better with the story of the junkets to Israel this week.
Well, I know every year when AIPAC has its convention, and each convention seems to be larger than the last, they had to even move it to another auditorium because there were so many people. I mean, 4,000 college students have their way paid by AIPAC to come there, and the leading members of both parties, from the Senate, from the House, they're one party. It's a pro-Israel party, and they make speeches, none of which ever get reported on them in the mainstream media, which is extraordinary. And then you've had your conferences; they don't get reported either. It's like Israel is a big story, except when it's not, when they don't want it to be. And go on.
Well, I was just going to say there are a lot of closed sessions at the AIPAC National Conference, and the joke always every year is they have a conference on media, and it's closed to the media. Or they'll have Mike Pence speak, and really the only outlet that covers it would be C-SPAN, and it's late at night or early in the morning, and nobody sees that either. So it's extremely disappointing, but the whole purpose, and this is one of the primary things that AIPAC and now increasingly Christians United for Israel does, it has nothing to do with policy or debates or ideas. It's really just a chance to have a cattle call of politicians so that they can rest assured that they're not going to be primaried or opposed by these groups when they operate back in the home districts. And frankly, the real purpose then is to also have their follow-up lobbying meetings on the Hill where, you know, they are received because they're understood to be backed by money. Ilhan Omar may have said it's all about the Benjamins, but in the case of AIPAC, it's really all about coordinated campaign contributions orchestrated by AIPAC. And it's another topic that they work very hard not to reveal. You always hear them speaking as if it's in code that you'll have a Israel lobby pundit saying, well, Congress passed this. They're in support of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, when really that entire thing was a massive effort that began in 1995 with incredible pressure, incredible amounts of money behind it. And no, none of these things would happen without this $6 to $10 billion lobbying effort every year that consumes so much American energy. And yet the lobby is eager to portray it as something that Congress does of its own volition or that, you know, Americans support. And it gets back to things like the Gallup poll, which up until this year would steadfastly say that Israel and sympathy for Israel was higher than ever every single year. And yet a little bit of digging, we find out that's false. And so it really is quite a show, but the damage that it does to this country, whether in terms of, you know, just generating impetus for a permanent U.S. military occupation in the Middle East, wasting money, subsidizing Israeli companies and the Israeli government. It's an incredible disaster for your average U.S. taxpayer. And so, you know, just getting back a little bit to the junkets to Israel, I think, and the media, it's interesting to me what happens when there is a brief breakthrough or a gaffe, such as when AIPAC's David Steiner was recorded by Harry Katz when he was pressuring Katz to donate to specific candidates, and AIPAC's president Steiner told him, quote, we have a dozen people in the Clinton headquarters, they're all going to get big jobs, and unquote. And he was talking about directing campaign contributions to AIPAC supported candidates. That's the sort of thing that almost never gets out, but Katz recorded him. He didn't like it, he didn't like being pressured, and it got out, and Steiner had to resign. But, of course, he had Thomas Friedman from the New York Times later claiming that, oh, Steiner was just boasting, we don't have that kind of influence. So this thing is perpetual, and it's growing. It's not retreating.
Of course, Friedman, after Netanyahu came to the United States and spoke before both houses of Congress trying to stop the Iran deal, Friedman actually wrote that Congress was bought and paid for by the Israeli lobby.
Right, but if you look at his long career, Friedman has been absolutely terrible on most of these issues. People really laud him. But back when Arnon Milchan was helping through the smuggling network get nuclear triggers illegally smuggled out of the United States to Netanyahu and the Ministry of Defense, Thomas Friedman was defending him, saying, no, these things could be used for heating soup. This is nothing. Look the other way. So you got to look at the overall record.
You exposed, for your Freedom of Information Act files, you've exposed so much in one instance where the FBI forgot to redact the name of the person on the receiving end of the nuclear triggers from Arnon Milchan, and that happened to Benjamin Netanyahu, and that should have been a major story in the United States.
Right. But, you know, the lobby is extremely anxious to keep that thing out of the press. I believe there's been one sort of throwaway reference to Milchan and the nuclear smuggling on National Public Radio, and that's about it. I mean, the documents are there. It's a story. But if a story like that was allowed and properly reported, it would absolutely turn Americans against Benjamin Netanyahu. We did do a poll before his visit, stating that he had been involved, according to the FBI, in a nuclear weapons technology smuggling ring. Should he be allowed to enter the U.S. without being interviewed by the FBI? Most Americans said no, he shouldn't be. If he's involved in that level of crime, in a smuggling network that they think is targeting the U.S., of course he should be interviewed. But that's the world we live in. It's this upside-down world where criminals are given 50 standing ovations and people trying to report and get some sort of warranted political action like Paul Findlay lose their media access the minute they start having an impact.
It's interesting, even the Iran deal, was a lot of stories about, you know, big fanfare about Trump nixing it. But in fact, Obama had to go around AIPAC and make it into an agreement, not a treaty, so the Senate would not have a chance to override it because the Senate would not have approved that Iran deal. But what they did was they passed something, a bill that required the president to every 90 days ratify the agreement, see that it was working, and that was like a poison pill, which then would enable Trump to legitimately pull the U.S. out of it. So that was a victory for AIPAC, even though at the time it was presented as a lost AIPAC. But AIPAC was playing the long game. They knew the next president, whoever it would be, might nix the deal. But we don't hear anything about that. It's just we see this happening over and over and over again.
Right. I would say that was a lesson learned from the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Act, where they couldn't just ram that through, and so they put in this six-month waiver process in which the U.S. president had to, every 6 months, look at the political winds and decide whether or not he was going to not move the embassy to Israel. So it's a poison pill, and it had only one beneficiary. That was a foreign government trying to make its case to the world. What these Congress people are doing, aligning themselves so closely with the foreign regime, is absolutely amazing.
Well, Grant, I'm wondering if this Chinese port deal, it's a major deal for Israel, and actually China is building a light rail in Israel. They have a lot of investments there. If at this point Israel can get away with having a major Chinese company run its ports where the U.S. Navy is used to serving, is bringing, having its ship serviced and its sailors going ashore for shore leave. Certainly, this is something that would not sit well with most Americans. They would not understand it, particularly when the United States is, or Trump administration is, waging an economic war on China. Do you think that has any legs? Or do you think Israel is going to cave in? Is there a way to predict what's going to happen on that? Can they keep it secret from the American people?
I think it's interesting. It's an interesting question. Back in the Reagan administration, AIPAC strongly pushed Israeli ports as a place for R&R and refueling and even medical care in the event of a war started by who knows who in the Middle East, that Israel would be the U.S.'s so-called aircraft carrier. And we've always seen these articles, particularly from progressives who are saying that this is all about the U.S.'s unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East, that it absolutely controls as a client state. But this is an indication that, no, this aircraft carrier, if it is one, is not driven by the U.S., and it's not always going to be available. So I think to the extent that there would be any critical reporting about this, I think the answer is no. If anything, it will simply be ignored until some sort of strategy emerges and the Mark Dubowitzes and other Israel lobby talking heads can be placated with some talking points that they can espouse if ever asked on a public event. I don't think it's going to be a big deal. It's kind of like the Israelis turning their entire Atoms for Peace nuclear weapons or nuclear infrastructure for civilian purposes into their own national laboratory for producing weapons. The U.S. never did anything about it. The international community never did anything about it, and they got away with it. So I don't understand why they wouldn't get away with this.
Well, if China seems to have invested billions of dollars in the Middle East, and given that we have internet, although the internet has its limits, as we've seen, I'm just really, actually, I'm hoping, actually, personally, that this will stir up some kind of an observation of whether Israel's our ally, which is questionable. Certainly, if it's our aircraft carrier, our American aircraft carrier would not be going to the port of Haifa if China's running that port.
Well, you never know. I just think that the overall U.S. sentiment, Americans, like any other country, are very nationalistic. They're very protective of their culture and their history, and they've been able to absorb this mythology that somehow the Israelis are this great ally, when in fact they've caused more chaos in the Middle East and more trouble and involved the U.S. in more trouble than anybody knows. And so I think that in terms of they're not being able to finesse that story, I think they could probably finesse it. But there is, I think, undoubtedly growing American popular knowledge, as this poll shows, that something is very, very wrong with this so-called special relationship.
And you, Grant, you're one who has been exposing it. And if people want to get more information, go to your website, irmep.org. Get something cold to drink, sit back, and you will find amazing information on that, which will turn your head and make your blood boil, maybe. The polls that Grant has taken, plus articles about what has been going on that has been hidden from the mainstream media. So thanks very much, Grant. Look forward to having you again. Take care. Keep the great work going.
Much appreciated.
This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.